File is part of the Swiss Libri Lecture Podcast series. Feel free to share it with friends, family, and colleagues, but we ask you to respect our copyright. So feel free to share it online, but preserve this message and don't modify the file in any way. Also, the views expressed in the lecture and discussion time are not necessarily representative of the views of Libri Fellowship.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Swiss Libri Podcast. This episode is a cross-post from one of our other branches, the Libri near Boston, or Southborough Libri. It's about the issue of whether God is a projection, and how we project our own images onto God. And after the lecture on imagination in our last episode, I think it's interesting to have this lecture point us to some of the ways that the imagination can go astray and create a phony God for ourselves. This God is often in contrast with who God is as he is revealed in Scripture and in the person of Christ. So, big thanks to Dave Friedrich at the Boston Libri, who gave this lecture and who has kindly allowed me to borrow it for our podcast. And I hope you all enjoy it and engage with it well. I find it a very interesting topic.
Welcome to the Friday night lecture here at Southborough Libri. Did you get a cookie yet? Wow, those are good, aren't they? If you didn't get one, get one afterwards with the coffee. And yes, if you don't know me already, my name is Dave Friedrich. I'm one of the workers here at Libri. And yes, we're glad you're here. We pray for God to bring the people of his choice, and we're thankful that he brought you. And on that note, next week, our own Ben Kies will be continuing his lecture series on gratitude, the tug of war between gratitude and entitlement. So, yeah, that's last lecture of the term, I think. So make sure you come out. Well, for tonight, let's get right to the point. Is God a social construct? Or put differently, is God merely a figment of our imagination? Or a projection of the mind? How do we respond to this kind of question? Or how do we respond to someone who says, yeah, of course? Or what do I do if I feel compelled to answer yes? Big questions. And this hour is going to take your concentration. It won't be a walk through the park. Consider how the following is a parable of projection. Okay? Imagine you are Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. Or if you're a guy, you can be Theodore. Okay? Imagine there you are in Kansas, and then suddenly this whirlwind takes you, your dog, your house, all the way to Oz, to this uncivilized place where they still have wizards and witches. And yes, despite the talking animals and the magic and the bright colors, all you want to do is go back to gray Kansas. Well, because that's where your family is. That's where your home is. That's where you belong. But you hear, well, the only way I can get back is through this wizard, this mysterious person who they say came from the clouds, who has incredible powers, never or rarely seen by his subjects. Well, you're determined to see him because you want to get home. So off you go, and on your way, of course, you meet a scarecrow, you meet the Tin Man, you meet the lion, and they join you on your journey, and you're all hoping that this powerful Oz will give you each what you desire. And after a long time, you get there, and he says, well, actually, before I can give you anything, you gotta kill the Wicked Witch, and you're not really into killing people, but after some adventures and accidentally killing you, you come back a second time, and there, this time, his true identity is exposed. And so Toto, yeah, totally, or accidentally tips over the screen, and there for all to see is this little man. This guy who used to work in the circus, a ventriloquist from Omaha, Nebraska. And he's trying really hard to convince everybody that there is a wizard, when in fact there is none. It's all an illusion. And so, you blurt out, and you say, I think you are a very bad man. And he responds, oh, I'm really a very good man, but a very bad wizard. I must admit. And he admits he has nothing to give you or your friends. In fact, everything you've needed, you've had within yourself. So you're like, yeah, okay, the scarecrow figured out how to get the brain power, the lion got some courage, the tin man got some heart, all without the help of the wizard. And you've been wearing shoes the whole time that could have got you home at any minute, any moment. And yet, if you read the book, after this, the scarecrow and the tin man and the lion insist that the wizard still give them the brain, the heart, and courage. And so reluctantly, he gives the scarecrow a brain full of bran, a brand new brain, and the tin man a silk heart full of sawdust, and the lion a potion of courage. And so their unshakable faith in the wizard gives these otherwise useless items this superstitious satisfaction. And here's how it ends. Oz, left to himself, smiled to think of his success in giving the scarecrow and the tin woodman and the lion exactly what they thought they wanted. How can I help being a humbug, a fraud, he said, when all these people make me do things that everybody knows can't be done? So to imagine this is to imagine how many people think and feel about God. That behind the curtain, there's just con men and illusions. So for some, this is good news. For others, this is bad. Yeah, how do we respond to this? Big question. I've titled this lecture, Is God a Social Construct? It could be asked differently. Is God just a crutch, a coping mechanism? Wim Reichkirk, the retired director of Dutch Labrie, has given a lecture numerous times called Is God a Projection? And a similar one, Is God an Ideology? And they're printed actually in this book, along with other lectures. He's also given the lecture many times, and this is one of the most important Labrie lectures I've read and listened to. I listened to it about 20 years ago, and if anything, it's more relevant today than when Wim started lecturing on it, I think over 30 years ago. That's right, Dick, you would probably know. Yeah, I encourage you to read or listen to the lectures if you get a chance, but I'm going to basically briefly mention thinkers that he devotes a lot more time to in his lectures, Feuerbach, Marx, and Freud. And then I'm going to try and build off of his lecture and take it further down some different roads and mention some different people than he does. People like the contemporary author Yuval Noah Harari. Just wondering, who's read him? I know Dick has. Okay. Or heard of him? Okay. Well, tonight you will. He's really expressing one of the most recent versions of this question. And this question, it can be asked in different ways depending on the discipline it's being asked in. So whether it's history or philosophy or psychology, the social sciences, genetics, neuroscience, each has their own way of asking the question, although it's rarely a question. It's usually a declared fact, something everybody knows. Of course. But yet, despite the different ways it can be expressed, the root and implication and response can be similar, quite similar. So I hope to offer you tonight a way to be able to recognize it when you hear it in different disciplines or different contexts. So you can hear that common root and implication, and then I'm going to offer a response. That's far from my own. It comes from what I have read and heard with my own tweaks here and there. And I hope it may help you. First, the saga. When was this question slash declaration born? When did it come into history, really? How did it develop into a teenager, and how is it behaving as a full-grown adult here in 2018? So that's going to be the first half. Second half will be the response. And you need to know the story to respond well, I think. So first, the tale. One of the teachings LaBrie takes very seriously is that we were made in the image of our Maker. So that even in our brokenness, each of us represents and reflects our Creator in our humanity, in the fullness of our humanity. And yeah, Anna had a reading this morning, and that explained that in a powerful way at the end from Madeline Lengel. Well, over the last 200 years, certain influential thinkers have claimed the exact opposite. That's what's going on here, that we have made our Maker in our image, if that makes sense. So God merely reflects and represents our imagination. And so in other words, God doesn't exist. He's merely a fiction, a figment of our imagination, a projection, an illusion, a social construct, a genetic hang-up from the past, something that helped us survive sometime in the past, these kinds of things. The birth of this idea came during the 1800s, at a time when philosophers were becoming aware of just how much humans are interpreters of reality, so that we don't just receive information passively from the world, from each other. We actively interpret. This is Immanuel Kant, if you're into philosophy. He really put this on the map. Well, the German philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach, you're going to hear that name a few times tonight, born in 1804, died in 1872. He took this new insight and he took it way down the road and applied it in a radical way to God. That's what he did. So that he's the first one that I know of that explicitly declared God is nothing but a projection. Or that he's nothing but our creative interpretation, not received from reality, but put onto reality. So in 1841, he wrote a book called The Essence of Christianity, where he tells us anthropology, the study of humanity, of human beings, anthropology is the essence of Christianity. And so in other words, when we think we're talking about God, in fact, we're merely talking about ourselves. And so whatever we lack or think we lack in ourselves, that's what we're projecting onto ultimate reality and call this God. So just like a projector projecting a movie onto a blank screen, kind of, we project Christianity or religion onto it. And the only reality God has is in our wish for him to exist. This wish fulfillment. And the greater the need, the greater projection. And so listen to this sweeping, dismissive, one-sentence summary. Only the poor man has a rich God. Whew. Punch in the gut from Feuerbach. So he saw this exposure as good news. We're no longer dependent on an illusion for salvation. We can get down to business and to start depending on ourselves. All the resources we need are within ourselves. You hearing the wizard here? the Wizard of Oz, who tries, yeah, to tell the Tin Man, the Straw Man, and the Lion. They didn't need some ominous magical wizard anymore, a god to save them. All they needed was right there. Now, Feuerbach prophesied that this unmasking of religion and Christianity would soon do away with it. And while that is far from being the case, his ideas have had a lasting influence all the way up to the present even in children's stories. And he probably didn't foresee how postmodernists would take what he's doing with God and apply it to everything, not just God. But that's getting ahead. One of his biggest disciples was Karl Marx, who took his ideas and applied them into the area of politics and economics. Karl Marx living from 1818 to 1883. This is when it's developing into a teenager. And like Feuerbach, Marx was, there is no objective reality to religion. Religious beliefs were merely the products of struggles in the classes of society when there's injustice going on. So religion was a means for capitalist property owners to keep the remaining masses of the poor in check in their place with the promise, hey, if you just stay there, don't worry. In the next age, you'll get what's coming to you. So don't make too much fuss. And on the other end, it was a tranquilizing drug for these poor, the opium of the people, the opiate of the masses, as we've heard it called, for those suffering injustice and unable to do anything about it. They were forced, in a sense, to invent or submit to this idea. Well, at least God will fix things in the next age. So where Feuerbach said the poor man had a rich God, Marx might say the suffering poor have a tranquilizing God. And Marx wasn't as belittling as Freud, because he was like, well, this is a sign of suffering that we need to address. Freud was a little more belittling, Feuerbach. Freud's coming. But he thought that a proletariat revolution that secured a classless society would do away with the religion, because the conditions that made it necessary are not there anymore. So you don't need any more religious opium when everybody's equal. Well, while religion in general, Christianity in particular, have outlasted these Marxist prophecies, Marxist ideas have had a lasting influence, especially in academia, especially in the social sciences. Another disciple of Freud, and what you see just through history is someone taking Feuerbach's ideas and then applying them to a new discipline, and eventually then to everything. But Feuerbach took this and applied it, of course, to psychology and psychoanalysis. So he agreed, yes, Christianity is an illusion, but for Freud, the cause wasn't being poor or a class struggle, but childhood neurosis. And he spells this out in The Future of an Illusion, written in 1927. And this is what he wrote. These religious ideas, which profess to be dogmas, are not the residue of experience or the final result of reflection. They are illusions, fulfillments of the oldest, strongest, and most insistent wishes of mankind. The secret of their strength is the strength of these wishes. So not the poor man has a rich God, or the suffering class has a tranquilizing God, but the childish individual has an exalted divine father. So he believed that these unresolved childhood conflicts compelled us to invent a comforting, exalted divine father. And this is supposedly how the gods were born. The conflicted child has a comforting God. Another punch in the gut. To mature, to come of age, to grow up, to become a responsible adult, both individually and in society, as a whole, is to have the courage to admit there is no wizard. There's no exalted father in the heavens, right? It's bleak, but hey, that's just how it is. And like Dorothy and her friends, they're told all that you have, all that you need is within yourself. And for Freud, the biggest resource is science. And so while many have questioned Freud's unshakable faith in science, And some have wondered what wish fulfillments did Freud have that caused his beliefs or lack of beliefs. There's much to question his description of leaving childish, comforting, superstitious beliefs behind and courageously becoming an adult, atheist, scientific person of modernity. That's become a common script for many people in their journey to atheism. And we need to ask why many times. This is typically the gospel of atheism as it's put forward, the good news. And it's a narrative many people find purpose in and significance in. It's hard to do away with narratives. People are looking for them, and this is the narrative of atheism. And it can even feel for people daring and heroic to face the darkness all alone. And for others, of course, it brings utter despair. Well, the three people I've mentioned, these are men of modernism, which meant they had this incredible optimism, not only in unmasking religion and Christianity, but in what human reason, science, or Marxist revolt could accomplish. Many postmodernists call this confidence into question. That's the postmodern response. They've helped give us the postmodern skepticism and pessimism, and sometimes just outright despair at all of this. So they took Feuerbach's claim all the way down the road, not only God, but maybe everything is projection. Then what do we do? And we thought we liberated ourselves from the gods, but now we need to be liberated from ourselves. Now what do? Kind of thing. Now, despite this response, modern optimism continues. It's not like postmodernism just wipes out modernism. Modernism keeps on trucking right beside pessimistic postmodernism. And the reductionistic views that we've heard about have not gone away. They're either restated in the classical language of Feuerbach or Freud, or they're restated in new contexts, new language. So now we're moving into how it's behaving as an adult. So we've looked at philosophy, politics, psychology. Now we're moving into the social sciences. In 1966, Peter Berger and Thomas Luckman wrote The Social Construction of Reality, a real groundbreaking book. And they stressed how our knowledge is constructed socially. So while in the past people were looking more individually how people construct reality, they were looking more at how we do it as a group, as we interact with each other, and how we come to what everybody knows. And there's a weak version of this, and there's a strong version of this. The weak version can still leave room for an objective reality out there that that we can have a correspondence to some degree of our constructs and how things really are. And that reality can break in, and people can break into our constructs and reorder them and help them become more faithful to the way things are. But there's a strong version of social constructionism that leaves little to no room for objective reality. And a little to no room for a correspondence between what I'm imagining things to be and what's really there. And so it's all projection and no revelation, either from the world or from people or from God. And the thing is with this is people can mix and match with this. So you can have people who are, hey, I'm going to have a kind of a weak version of this when it comes to the world and science maybe and people. Yeah, I can get to know the world and I can get to know people slowly over time. Not perfectly, but at least better. And then there can be a switch when it comes to God. And then the strong version kicks in and God is nothing but a social construct. And even if he could talk to us, hey, there's no way he could break through all these social constructs we have. So intentionally or unintentionally, religious truth claims get swept under the carpet. So that, yeah, religion, it's constructed merely to deal with things we haven't understood yet. And the more science explains things, the less religion is necessary. And so where Marx said the suffering community creates a comforting God, here the poor, confused community creates a convenient God of the gaps. And that God gets smaller and smaller. So you hear this sometimes in Christian circles. Well, this can't be explained by science yet, so that's why God is real. Well, then science keeps explaining things, and God gets a lot smaller over time. And so we got to rethink, I think, what we're saying, how we're imagining God in the created order. But the guiding question in the social sciences, when it comes to religion at least, and Christianity, is typically not, what might we learn about God? The guiding question is typically limited to, what can we learn about human beings? So many times religion and Christianity just get reduced to, again, anthropology. So, you know, the question becomes, well, hey, what historical, cultural, social context caused this group of people to believe like this? That is an important question. It's a question a lot of Christians need to pay more attention to. But why limit ourselves to just that question? Why not also be open to the possibility that we have a creator who can communicate with us, despite our distortions of who he is or what he's like? The more recent versions of his God as social construct come from Darwinian biology and neuroscience. So this is another way, yes, our question's behaving as an adult. And the thinking goes, if we believe in God, like anything, that belief must have helped us survive, must have been helpful for our survival in the past. And so how much of that is inherited through our genes or through human culture is still a debate. But we get books like The God Delusion by the new atheist biologist Richard Dawkins. Or you have this interesting book by the geneticist Dean Hammer, or Hammer, is that how you say his name? Not sure, but he wrote The God Gene, How Faith is Hardwired into Our Genes. So he proposed that there's a specific gene, VMAT2, that predisposes humans to spirituality or mystical experiences that must have been beneficial for our survival in the past. Why else would we have something? And so while this God gene, I'm not sure how much credibility it has in the scientific community as a whole, and he doesn't rule out the reality of God in this by any means, but his thinking illustrates, or his book illustrates, the new kind of thinking at work. Is that, how did this belief, whatever it was, this religious belief, help us to survive, and how might it be carried through our genes, our genetic makeup? And then it can turn into, well, God is nothing but a genetic inheritance that helped us survive in the past. But of course, we don't need that anymore. We can grow up and move on. So now, while genetics used to be all the rage, now it's neuroscience. To say something authoritatively, you gotta throw in some neuroscience in there to make it sound credible. So joy, what's joy? Hey, joy is simply dopamine and serotonin in the brain. Next question, let's move on. That's what's going on. Not that we don't have things to learn there, but people are getting a little overexcited about it, I think. There's even something called neurotheology that attempts to explain religious experiences in neuroscientific terms. So Paul, you know, he's going on the road to Damascus. He thinks he had an encounter with Christ. He probably just had a seizure. That's some of the thinking. Now, it doesn't have to be that dismissive. It's just sometimes that's a track people take. So that you can still have room, make room for real encounters with God, and then be trying to describe what's going on in the brain when that happens, if you could really do that. But there is a dismissive approach that can sound something like, well, you think you're having an experience of God, but really you're just experiencing chemicals in your brain. And that might have helped us survive in the past, but we don't need that anymore. Only primitive Homo sapiens need to believe and experience God to survive and do well. All right, we're almost near the end of the saga. This brings us to Harari. Yuval Noah Harari. And which is the book here I'm going to mention? He wrote this book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. This is a New York Times bestseller, written in 2011. He is a professor of history at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And according to his TED Talk blurb, and the TED Talk has about 3 million hits, his book's been translated into 50 languages. Okay, so he's a historian who's something of an international rock star. I mean, you just look on videos of this guy, and there's tons of them. He's just talking to all kinds of people on all kinds of topics. And he's an interesting guy. He embodies so many different things. He embodies something of this scientific modern optimism, something of the pessimistic postmodernist take, as he filters everything through Darwinian biology and neuroscience, and with predictions of our transhumanist future, and throwing in a little Buddhism to boot. So he's not an easy guy to summarize and figure out. But his guiding question is, how did human beings rise from being these insignificant apes to these creatures that now dominate the planet? How did this happen? And the short answer he gives is our imagination. So this is something not totally new, but he gives it a new twist. According to Harari, only humans that we can tell have this ability to imagine, to have an imagination, which is for him the ability to create fictional stories. So when we all believe the same fictional story as humans, we can accomplish great things together that we never could have before, whether for good or for ill. So religious beliefs, they are merely one human fiction we have invented that have enabled us to come together in large numbers to accomplish great cultural feats and to dominate the planet. So if he was the wizard, he might have told Dorothy, okay, your little posse was believing a lie the whole time. You know, that's true. But look how it helped you come together and get everything you wanted. Isn't that great? Isn't that amazing? So conquering Homo sapiens need a unifying myth to do things together. And he doesn't just single out religion here. He goes and says money and corporations. He's got states and nations, legal systems and human rights. All of these are just human fictions. They come from the stories we tell. There's no reality to them. Human rights, he says, well, hey, this came from the Christian tradition where the Christians believe God gave humans certain value and dignity and status, being made in the image of God. But we know that's not true. So human rights as well are not true. And so he says, look, what do we do? Well, let's cut open the human body. And what do we see? You see a heart. You see lungs, you see DNA, but you don't see any human rights. You don't see a soul. So now we know that these are all inventions of the human imagination that come from the stories we tell. So he gives this illustration. He says, you know, take like a $20 bill and pretend you're going to give it to a monkey. And pretend the monkey can talk. And he says, tell him, this paper is worth all those bananas in your hand. And then say, let's do a trade. And the monkey's like, no way. Only humans believe those stories. And then he says, it's the most powerful story out there because everybody believes this one. All right. So for Harari, these stories, they're not worthless. They've enabled us to do incredible things, but just don't take them too seriously. Okay, the saga is over. Time for a response. Is anything unclear at this point? Confusing. Okay. There'll be a time for questions at the end, so if you've got questions, save them for then. So, depending on who you are, if you're a believer, your first response might be defensive, if you're normal. Understandably, you might want to fight back. You might want to punch Freud or Feuerbach in the gut, if you're honest. But what if, rather, we turned the other cheek and tried to learn something, tried to listen? There's a practice here at Labrie, and not only here at Labrie, but with many Christians and many people who aren't Christians, to first listen and see if there's something we can learn from someone, even someone who's hostile to our faith, to something that is very central to who we are and what we believe. And I say practice because we don't always do that. We don't always do that well, but we do try to practice what the Epistle of James says. Be quick to listen and slow to speak. That was in the Monday book study. Joshua should be familiar with that. The late theologian Karl Barth from Switzerland considered the state of Christianity in Germany during the times of Feuerbach, so in the 1800s, and was under the impression that much of what Feuerbach witnessed in theology and in Christian practice was projection. The church was in a bad way. And many times, yeah, Christians are the biggest reason for both people believing and people not believing. That's a big fact. That he noticed, though, there was very little Christian substance in the church at this time and a lot of misguided imagination going on. So Barth agreed with Feuerbach's critique of religion at this time to such a degree that in 1957 he wrote an essay, an introductory essay, to the essence of Christianity. And so he heard God's correction through Feuerbach of the church. Now we might wish Barth was corrected in other areas by God, and heard that, but we need that kind of listening, that humility to do that. That's not easy. What might God be saying to the church through its critics? Many times the critics sees where we're off better than we do. So we need to listen there. So maybe Dick needs to write an introductory essay to Rahr's book. Can you add that to your writing schedule? Yeah. I remember hearing a lecture by a Christian philosopher and apologist who said sometimes he read Feuerbach as devotional material when he wanted to see how much he was putting on to God that didn't belong to God. Yeah. So yeah, our response should be, let's listen. Let's see if there's something I can learn from this person. How can they teach me something new, maybe, about the human condition, about living in God's world even if they don't share my faith? How can they broaden my understanding in my life? This is what God wants for us, regardless of where it comes from. I love this phrase in Psalm 119, people have been reading in the morning prayer. It says in verse 32, you will broaden my heart. I love that phrase. God is into expanding our hearts, our lives. And scripture does this. But any truth does this, wherever we find it. And all truth is God's truth anyway.
What psalm was that again?
That's Psalm 119, verse 32. But sometimes before we can expand, we need to be corrected. We need to get things out of the way. And that correction can come from surprising places. Here's another psalm. This is Psalm 50, verse 21. And this is God speaking to his covenant people in the Old Testament, the church at that time. And theft, adultery, deceit, slander are mentioned. And then God says, these things you have done, and I have been silent. You thought that I was one like yourself. But now I rebuke you and lay the charge before you. So projection, it didn't start with Feuerbach. He can't claim full credit for that. It started with the scriptures. And many times it's associated with idolatry. So which is really just worshiping anything other than the God who made all things. And that can be a material thing. It can be a person. It can also be a concept, a wrong idea about God. And sometimes God's rebuke for this can come from places we're not ready for. We're not looking for. Sometimes people who just might be annoying to us, irritating messengers we don't want to listen to. But maybe there's something to be heard. So how can we do this with Karl Marx, for example? Well, we can learn a lot of things from him, I think. One of the things is how people have used religion or Christianity to oppress or manipulate other people. And how might we be doing that in our churches? How might we be using Christianity to manipulate people? Or how do we use our future hope as an excuse not to go through the tough work of being changed or working towards changing our living and working environments for other people? Well, don't worry, that's coming in the next. You can just sit easy and relax. And we need to hear Karl Marx, I think. What can we learn from Freud? Well, it's certainly true. What happens in our childhood affects our relationship with God, how we think about him, how we don't, how we relate or don't relate to him. That is surely true. Maybe not exactly the way Freud imagined it. Paul Witz is somebody who's taken some of his basic insights and worked with them and tried to correct them where he thinks they went off. But this is an area he brought our attention to more than we were before. And so now any decent Christian counseling at least will at some point ask, who were your parents? What were they like? And what was your relationship like with them? And how has this played out in your relationship with God? Because we typically do the opposite of what Jesus said to do, which is we take the deficiencies of our earthly fathers and apply it to our heavenly father and say, how much more? The exact opposite of what Jesus teaches us to do. So a lot of Christian life is about letting Jesus correct our constructs. Learning from him, what did he mean by that word, Father? And how can we know the Father as he knows the Father? It's a lot of what the Christian life is about. Merrill Westfall wrote this book, Suspicion and Faith, The Religious Uses of Modern Atheism. It's a big book at Labrie, Swiss Labrie. There's a lot of people here at Swiss Labrie tonight here. Well, what he does is, this is written in 1998. He's professor of philosophy at Fordham University in New York. And what he writes is that we should use the critiques of Feuerbach, Marx, Freud, even Nietzsche, for tools as of self-examination, what I've been talking about. So, in a sense, doing the Ignatian examine with these guys. He goes so far as to say these guys are like the Old Testament prophets in the Old Testament who expose projection, or rather idolatry. And all the corrupt practices that went with idolatry. So, this was an exposing that happened first and foremost with the people of God. It wasn't like God went, and out to the nations, was like, here, I'm gonna say what's wrong with you. First and foremost, it was with his own people, the prophets. But I think that the power of these prophets are even more than these men I've mentioned, because, hey, if you project a false idea about God and God doesn't exist, it's not that big of a deal. But if you project a false idea onto your maker, you deserve his wrath, as Paul says in Romans. You need forgiveness for that. You need redemption. You need to be redeemed. And thankfully, he's more than willing to do that. I wouldn't call these men prophets. They're more like the unbelieving nations, I think, around Israel in the Old Testament. So sometimes when Israel strayed from God and God's ways, he used the surrounding nations to judge them, to wake them up. It took that to do it sometimes. So I think if we're attentive, we too might hear God's correction through unbelievers. And this is a rebuke that can be found not just in modernist critiques, but in postmodern critiques too. And this is what Bruce Ellis Benson does in this book, Graven Ideologies. And so he goes to the postmodernists and does a similar thing with an inspiration from Westfall. And he looks at people like Nietzsche, but then others like Derrida, who continue to show how we make idols not just materially, but conceptually. How we have false ideas that we worship. And if you've done any theological training, you see this sometimes. You see people worshiping their theologies and their doctrines instead of the God of their theologies and doctrines. And that needs to be called out. Well, we also need to learn from the social sciences. So how our time and place in history really does influence how we see God. If you look at the paintings of Jesus through cultures and through the centuries, you notice Jesus ends up looking a lot like the people who are painting him. And that's not always wrong, but it's one of the factors. And sometimes that can help us see Jesus better, depending on what it is. And sometimes that can skew things. And so we need to think of our own time and culture. How does our culture help us see God better? And how does it block? How does it blind us? And as physical creatures, we need to know how our genes and the chemicals in our brain might affect our experience of God and how it does affect. How can we learn from this? How can we learn from these kinds of things? How can this, again, broaden our understanding? We need to be discerning, but we don't have to be afraid of any new discovery that's coming forth. And then there's Harari. Now, I don't share his atheistic orientation or his scientism. We'll talk about it in a minute, but he has all kinds of insights we need to pay attention to. How he highlights how we've been treating animals and each other and the planet. And what might be coming down the pipe in the future. There's some things there that we need to listen to. And I think most of the Christianity he presents is a Platonicized popular version of Christianity, a lot of which I would want to reject too. My guess, my hope, is that the Christians he must have rubbed shoulders with probably didn't have a lot of substance in their faith. That maybe they lost their saltiness, as Jesus said, and Harari and others want to throw it away, as Jesus said would happen. So again, how might God be rebuking the church through Harari? So yeah, we need to listen and learn. We need to learn how to listen, both for truth and distorted truth. So a partial truth presented as the total truth becomes a distorted truth. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot of in these men I've mentioned as well. from all that we can learn from them, I think a lot of this is going on. And so this is tricky. We're learning what to receive and what to resist from the same person. So how to chew the meat and spit out the bones kind of thing. And so, I don't think these critics have given some fatal blow to religious or Christian faith. So these ideas have been going on for a while, and they haven't shut down Christianity. But I hope if you haven't already, you'll be able to recognize and resist their reductionism. So yeah, reality is big and broad and deep. And we need to resist those who want to shrink it to one thing going on. And maybe you've heard that in these people. And especially you got to listen for those words like merely, just, nothing but. I hear those words and my alarm goes off. And I want to hear what's coming next. So we need to listen for those cues and then ask some questions. And so my question for these men would be, is your explanation really the total explanation of what's going on? Why does this have to be the only thing happening? So it's like when one insight becomes the only insight, we start to become dogmatic and narrow-minded and reductionistic. And that's one thing LaBrie has taught me, is listen for reductionism and resist it, wherever you find it. And so when we try to reduce life to one thing in life, we need to train our ears to hear this. So scientism is a type of reductionism, which limits all knowledge to what can be measured, say, for example. Good science, which there's plenty of, knows its limits, is a blessing to the earth, and makes room for other fields of knowledge. Say like poetry. Scientism knows not its limits. So imagine a huge circle that represents all of reality. Of course, you could never draw that big enough. And then within that, there's another little circle that represents what scientists have observed and they're trying to tell us about. And scientism claims that the only thing that can count as true and real knowledge is within that circle. So if your poetry circle is outside that somewhere, sorry, that doesn't count. Unless you can bring it inside our circle somehow. And so it's the nothing buttery fallacy. Life is nothing but, and then you fill in the blank. Life is nothing but biology or genetics or neuroscience. And Christians have their own ways of doing this too, right? We can have a circle of sin sometimes. Your depression, your boredom, your anxiety, it's nothing but sin in your life, always and every time. Well, yeah, we can all get our own little circles going on. The critics, though, here of Christianity say, your religion is nothing but your poverty, your class struggle, your childhood, your historical context, your genes, the chemicals in your brain, the vibrating strings of quantum mechanics. Again, see here we can reduce all of life or religion to one thing. And that's never a good thing. And it's typically the thing we just happen to be really into and get really excited about. And I do this too. I get into a new book and a new idea and suddenly that's everything. This is, you know, or it's like doing the Enneagram and suddenly you're just seeing the Enneagram and only the Enneagram everywhere where it's a helpful insight, but it's not the only insight. And this can easily just turn into another form of idolatry where we're these worshiping creatures. We just have to worship. And if we don't worship the God who created all things, our tendency is to worship some small thing in creation. Or two things, as Dick points out. Idols come in pairs. So yeah, we just need to be reminded of this over and over again. Life's bigger than what I'm into at this point or what I'm studying. I don't want to give that up necessarily. That's an important part of life, but it's not the only thing. And we shouldn't express it that way to anybody. And we need to be aware of people who do express that. And I think there's no other way for me, there's no better way that I've found to keep myself from doing this than Jesus, who is the Lord of all of life. Not just one little part of life. All of life in its fullness. And yes, he takes us through a narrow gate, but it's always to a broad place. He's not into constricting us. That's not his goal. His goal is to expand life, to expand us. And according to the physicists, he's even expanding the universe. Where reductionism is constricting, it's greedy, wants to claim too much in this. All history is merely the history of class struggle. So all philosophies, all religion, it's just a product of this class struggle. Well, if that's true, what about Marx's ideas? How did he escape this situation and give us the bird's eye view of everything? How come he's there and the rest of us are left down here? So to dismiss all ideas is to dismiss your own ideas too. And so we need to learn to hear that and have that question. Or how about Freud when he said belief in this exalted divine father brings people comfort. Therefore, religion and Christianity are nothing but a comforting illusion. Do you hear that big jump he made there? Just because you wish for something and it's comforting doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So I have a big desire to eat another cookie around the corner. Just because I wished that doesn't mean those cookies aren't there. I hope they're still there. We'll see how many are left. Or in the opposite way, what if atheists like Freud have a desire for God not to wish? And what if that's comforting to them? Does that somehow prove God does exist? See that when psychology is used to prove or disprove Christianity, it's overextending its limits. It's claiming too much. And when we reduce what people say to why they say it, we're cheapening them, right? Because we could do that to Freud too, but we shouldn't do that to him or to anybody, and don't let anybody do that to you. All right, got another 5 minutes or so. And I think the same goes for Harari. And he insists when it comes to Homo sapiens, only Darwinian biology is objectively true. So it's a form of scientism that we talked about. So all beliefs and values we hold are merely subjective creations of our imagination. They've helped us to evolve and dominate the world, but they're not true. Well, if this is true for all Homo sapiens, wouldn't that include Harari's imagination? I wonder. So his book doesn't simply report observations of biology in some detached way without imagination. He's using his imagination to reconstruct the story, the history behind all these facts. He's using a whole lot of imagination to reflect on the importance and the significance of these supposed facts. He's making value judgments. He's filling in some gaps with his imagination. So how come his imagination can produce the history, a brief history of humankind, but the rest of us can only produce an imagined fiction of humankind? That would be my question for Harari if I met him. I wouldn't start off with that question, but I would want to talk with him. He seems like an interesting human being, very creative. I really enjoy reading his book, and I'm mad at him sometimes too, but I would love to get to know him. But when a claim like this becomes self-defeating, like this, it's probably a sign something's going too far, claiming too much, and I think we can be thankful that more is going on in our life than what we're being told. The other day, Josh was telling me how one way to understand heresy in church history is a lack of imagination. In fact, so for example, either Jesus is God or he's human. Well, we know he was human, so he can't be God. So there's no imagination for how he could be both. So it's about false dilemmas here, really, is either this or that, instead of an imaginative way of saying, how could it be a third way or both? So what if life isn't about an either or, either total modernist objectivity or total postmodern subjectivity? What if it's a mix of both and both are at play? Or what if the history of religion isn't an either or, either human imagination or God communicating himself? What if it's really a both and? Both the story of how humans distort and project and sometimes get it right, and how God reveals himself and can overcome our distortions and projections. So why assume because humans can imagine things and imagine even false things that everything they imagine is false? And that God does not exist because of that, or he can't overcome that or deal with that. And we can't work on that together somehow. So if there's a personal creator, and I believe there are good reasons to believe in a personal creator, revelation from him might be something we would expect, would it not? Something to look for, something that could even inform us and correct us. So just even consider the history of science. So people imagine all kinds of crazy stuff about how the world works. But gradually over centuries, as we've humbled ourselves and been attentive and allowed creation to speak to us in a sense, we've been slowly correcting the ways we've understood the way things work. And if that can happen in science, why can't that happen in other fields outside of science? Even of personal relationships. You first meet somebody and they start talking like somebody else you know, and they look like them, and oh, that person is just like so-and-so. And then you start paying attention and they reveal themselves to you, and oh shoot, no, I was projecting onto them. But over time, that was getting corrected. And so that should be hopeful that we can do that not just in human relationships, but in our relationship with God. So that God's no blank screen that we just put our projections onto. He answers back. And he's the creator who speaks, who has and is revealing himself in the world, in the scriptures, in his son. In his son through whom he judges and forgives and overcomes our distortions. So that through the cross we get the mind, are given the mind of Christ that knows the Father without distortion or inhibitions whatsoever. And through the Spirit and the scriptures, we can receive that mind one degree at a time so that we too can enjoy the sweet knowledge of the Father that Jesus has. So finally, there once was a man named Job who lived in the land of Uz. And he didn't come to this land by a whirlwind. Rather, God came to him in a whirlwind. And Job's three friends, eventually Job himself, they start spewing out all kinds of assumptions about God. Projections, social constructs, imaginations. And God let this go on for a little while. And then he showed up in this vortex of wind with a severe mercy. To rebuke, yes, but also to reveal and restore. And God still comes in the wind of his Spirit, and he speaks to us in scripture, sometimes in skeptics, and fully and finally through his son. So may we have ears to hear. Thank you. Thank you.